So yes, hello everyone. This is a aggressive case of slide reuse. Basically, this is based on something I did literally 5 years ago, sort of during my offboarding while I worked at CERN. That means that I mostly don't remember many things in there anymore. It's like just some vague ideas that have stuck around. But also, basically, I never got to give that talk, and I put a lot of effort into slides, so that is why I wanted to, at some point, publish this. I try to make this not depend on any high-energy physics knowledge. That should be doable. I try to also not assume too much math knowledge. That will be hard. There will be math. Or, like, very abstract things. But anyways. I also then noticed in my old slides that apparently I had based these ideas on some discussions with people in 2018. Which I entirely forgot about. So anyways, a bit of background. I used to work for the CMS experiment. It's like this big thing somewhere there in Geneva, actually in France, but like at the LHC. It's one of the big experiments at the LHC. And the thing you need to be aware of here is that this is a detector that consists of a lot of smaller subdetectors. Each of the subdetectors consists of then usually hundreds to thousands of modules. And if you have this number of components, you just assume that something is broken all the time. Like, you can't really maintain the thing while it's running, so you're not really like fixing the issues, you're mostly just managing them and trying to understand what the issues are. And this is what we're talking about here. Bit of off-topic mention here, like, this thing is running currently, like, the long shutdown has ended, we are now taking data. This is from Sunday, but you can go to this URL today and see the live data taking. This is like an actual LHC event from a few days ago. Okay, so what is DQM? This is like a very standing term in high energy physics. And basically, this is the monitoring of the data that comes out of the experiment. This is not like temperatures or anything, not like things you measure in addition to the normal measurements. This is also not like CPU load or anything. This is really looking at the physics data that falls out of the experiment and trying to understand if the detector is working correctly or not. And there's two goals in this. One is that for every chunk of data that comes out, we want to know if at this moment the detector was actually working well, which means we can use it for physics, or whether something was broken, so we can't do physics with it. This is sort of the bigger role, sort of the certification role. But it's also a monitoring role that, okay, if something breaks in real time, we want to know and like take action if required. And now a very high energy physics thing is that the thing you look at is histograms. And I have a bit of the issue since I worked there that nobody really understands histograms or really uses histograms despite them being actually a really cool tool. So yes, expect to see lots of histograms. What is a histogram? A histogram is basically a data structure that counts how often some value appeared. That is at least how I would display it. That is how Root, which is the toolkit that we use at CERN, deals with them. And in DQM, generally, we produce histograms of like all the quantities, and then we count these quantities for like all the units, which is like thousands of components, and then like hundreds of quantities, and we easily end up with like millions of histograms in the end. I did at some point count how many histograms were in our data archive. And it's actually more histograms than we have like events stored. So it's kind of a lot. and this was just the background. Now we jump into like the mathy part. Just a bit of more background though. There's an interesting thing if you look at like spaces and dimensions. And this is sort of completely freestanding now. But basically you look at a line at like a quantity. And they say like, okay, the middle is fine, and then like you have sort of outliers at the ends, and say the middle is like 90%, that's sort of the usual part, and then like 5% outliers at both ends. And then like, yeah, sure, like 5% outliers, or like 10% outliers on both ends, like 90% in the middle, it's all fine. But now if you start adding dimensions to this, something interesting happens. Because if you do this in two dimensions, you already see that like 20% of the total area actually in sort of the outlier region. Then you look at this in like three dimensions and it's like already 27% that are sort of at the edge. And it turns out if you just increase the number of dimensions, basically every data point becomes an outlier. Like it's just the probability that a point falls into the inside of the volume becomes diminishingly small. And here we are looking at like up to 10 dimensions. This is not what I would consider high dimensional. Like we will get to millions of dimensions at some point. This just has consequences. For example, another thing is that if you look at distances of random points, they start to become somewhat constant. Basically, if you look at distances between random points in high-dimensional spaces, the distance is just increasingly constant. Like they're all equally far apart. But that's somewhat weird, and that can lead to very confusing effects if you start to like understand the structure of like high-dimensional point clouds. It's just something to keep in mind. High-dimensional spaces are really, really weird. So now we can look at sort of the stuff that we actually care about, which is LHC events. LHC event is basically one bunch crossing, which is like one cluster of protons crossing another cluster of protons, and some of them collide. And each of these events that get recorded has a bunch of parameters, like number of particle tracks that we found, number of clusters that those tracks produced, that sort of thing. And basically, if you look at all these quantities, we can like consider each of these events as like one point in a high-dimensional space. But these are the events. These are basically a volume of data we know we can't really handle. So then what we do is we take these events and count how often each value appears, do a histogram. And essentially, a histogram is just a projection out of the high-dimensional space into a lower-dimensional space. And yes, that is a bit of a stretch. Like, this is not entirely true, because we sometimes count things that are not one per dimension, but like multiple per event, but like multiple per event. Also, it is not strictly a projection because there is a transition from like individual points to like the histogram structure. But anyways, essentially, we are approximating a high-dimensional structure in a low-dimensional space. And we have to understand that going from a high-dimensional space to a lower-dimensional space is lossy. Like we will lose data on the way. And we cannot go back from the reduced data to the original data. That is the full point of it. We wanted to reduce the data volume. But we somehow hope that we can still do something with the data. So now if you look at the histograms, we can do the same thing again. Basically, every bin of the histogram, like every column that you see in there, is also a dimension. It is a number. And like if you have many histograms, then you have many of those numbers. And basically, every histogram is a multidimensional structure. And you can also look at like many histograms. In the end, if you look at the histograms, of course, these are very highly correlated dimensions, because basically if you look at two histogram bins next to each other, they tend to have similar values. So generally, these dimensions don't add much information. They're sort of very correlated, very much the same thing. But the interesting thing is that if you now reduce the space to a lower dimensional space, you expect that basically all of these points lie sort of on a surface in this high dimensional space, sort of a manifold is the correct term there. A lower dimensional volume within a higher dimensional space. And while what the histograms look like is very arbitrary, like you can have finer bins or coarser bins in the histogram, this is very arbitrary. You can also put like more data in one histogram or less, you can sort of get a smoother or more flat histogram. This is all very arbitrary, but we sort of hope that once we extract this manifold, like this lower dimensional structure that is hidden within the high dimensional space, that then actually this is somewhat inherent to the data we started from. Like this is the idea of many machine learning methods, if not all machine learning methods. And basically what we're looking for now is a dimensionality reduction method that allows us to manage dealing with very high dimensional spaces. Good, and now let's look at some colorful pictures. Generated some synthetic data, and I've made some plots, and there's nothing to see there. There's like a three-dimensional data set. I looked at a few projections. There's really nothing going on there, right? Oh, wait. Turns out if you look at the wrong dimensions, you might miss something somewhat obvious. And now this was three dimensions, so like there is a very easy solution to this. You just make a 3D plot, right? But is this a 3D plot? Well no, this is a 2D image. Like this is on a flat screen. So like clearly we have somehow found a method how we can display something high dimensional in a low dimensional space that happens to work pretty reliably, despite being a very stupid method. Like, how does this work? And like, this is basically what we call a random projection. Like, we have done a projection of the high dimensional space, in this case only three dimensions, into a low dimensional space, in this case only two dimensions. That is pretty much just random. We look at the data from a random direction, and then we can usually see the structure of the data. So does this work with more dimensions? I mean, I guess you can guess what is hiding in those 10 dimensions here. And whoops. Yes, it works. Like, sure, this is like not as clear as like the other example, but still you can see that there is some obvious structure hiding in those 10 dimensions. And this is just a random projection. This is like just a random like transform applied to the original 10-dimensional data set. So random projections are basically just you take like all the dimensions you have, you multiply each of them with a random weight, then you sum them up. This gives you like one projection. Then you make a bunch of them, like as many as you like. They are all completely independent, so you can first start with like 10, and then you add like another 10 if you feel like that. And that gives you then a lower dimensional data set. And the nice thing is that this doesn't depend on data at all. Like, this is not a trained method. This is not a trained model. This is really just like you look at the data once, sort of you can stream the data through, and then get a reduced data set out. And what this gives us that like almost no other method can do is that this looks at all dimensions at the same time. The strength of this is like in not missing anything. So now, why was this relevant for like the application we had there? Well, we have millions of histograms and like millions of dimensions. Basically, there is no other method that is able to process this volume of data at like a reasonable compute budget. Like, the compute here happened on like my laptop, so it's like all pretty manageable. There's no method that could do this except for this one. Of course, what other people have done is like there were many experiments on like machine learning things, and they just looked at like some small subset of data. Like, they were like, oh, okay, maybe this histogram might be useful to spot this problem. So like they trained a model on this. I was like, but it doesn't really work properly. So that is why I was like, maybe we can look at all data at once. So really the idea was, can we like just see things if you look at the big picture and not miss everything, miss anything? So this gets a bit technical here. Basically, the result is that I ended up with like a 1,000 dimensional data set out of a million dimensional data set, and like 1,000 dimensions is actually manageable. This might be surprising, but like 1,000 dimensions is kind of okay. And then we can actually look at like sort of just random pairs in this case. So this is like really still just a two-dimensional random projection. And I mean, clearly there is some structure. Like, this data is not random. There's something going on. And then now comes the normal machine learning part, basically. So normally, if you want to reduce dimensionality, you do PCA, and then you get like this knee plot that sort of shows how much impact individual dimensions had. And like the first few dimensions are pretty big, and then it gets kind of small. And then you reduce the data set to like the first few dimensions. And then you get something like the plot over there, which shows you like the two main dimensions, which are sort of as we interpret now, LHC parameters. And then like there's sort of the noise towards the end, which is sort of the error in the end, the deviation from the expected values. And now if you do this PCA thing, like in case you have seen this before, there's a common thing that they look at the eigenvectors, like there's the famous eigenphases like paper or like idea from a bunch of years ago, where the observation was that if you take eigenvectors out of photos, you can basically see the structure of faces in there. If you look at the eigenvectors here, they are basically useless because the data is random. Like, it's random projections, the eigenvectors are random. But if you look at the latent space, basically like the where the points lie, that makes sense. Like, this we can see parameters here that we know exists. And then we can start looking at the points that are sort of not on this plane, that are outside of this manifold that we have extracted from the high dimensional space. And fun stuff happens. So in this graph, basically, I plotted the error between the reduced representation and the original data, or like the original random projection I had, which is already reduced. And then you see that like some data is like usually somewhere down here, but like some data is actually very much like shows a lot of error. So it's like pretty high up. And then I looked at sort of our other data and our logs and stuff, is like, is there anything wrong? And it turns out, yes, basically for each of them, I did find an actual problem. So this method has, without any training, like this is a completely unsupervised machine learning method that has spotted actual problems in our experiment, not at the same quality as like the established procedure, but like at least it has worked at all. Like what you see on there is like individual modules that were broken. Like these could be identified from the like maintenance log of the detector. Then there's a bit more like magic. Basically, the issue is that since we randomly mix all the data, once you see an error, you don't know where it comes from. So what I did is I basically divided the detector into its subdetectors, and then ran the stuff independently on the subdetector. That allows me to see which component contributes most of the error. That's how I could track down that like most of these things come from like the RPC, and then like some comes from the tracker or whatever. Basically, I could blame this on individual components. And there were a few things that were a bit odd. Like for example, here it's very clear that like this cluster here, which is all like from one run, like from one piece of data, clearly decomposed into like two sections that are very clearly different. And this is actually not really documented. Like there is some vague hints that something was changed before that run, but unsure. So yes, we also observed a few things that were not really caught by normal monitoring. Like this did not show up anywhere else. This is like, okay, we know we changed something, but we haven't really seen this effect anywhere. So in the end, it turns out that random rejections are a very simple method that happens to be somewhat effective. Like it actually gives you structure. And the interesting thing is that because it's so simple, it is feasible to apply. It is feasible to apply it to all data you have. And that is where the strength lies. Normally, if you like think about what you could watch out for to spot problems, you tend to ignore almost everything. Like you tend to forget looking at stuff. And by taking a random reflection, you sort of get a chance to just look at everything and then see if anything deviates a bit. And of course, this is not a method on itself. I just did a random projection as pre-processing to be able to then like apply some PCA. And instead of PCA, you could use any other classical machine learning method. So like you still have to do some of the hard work. But random projections are a sort of somewhat forgotten method to reduce huge volumes of data into more manageable volumes of data without actually ignoring anything. And yes, so that is the conclusion I want to leave here. So if you have lots of data, consider just like randomly summing up the dimensions and see what happens. Yeah, if you want to know more, I can talk about this for a long time, so feel free to ask questions.
You made my brain melt, thank you. I wonder, these random weights, it's like choosing one random vector in the same dimension as original data. So would you pick them independently of each other, or make an orthogonal basis or something? Or are they in high-dimensions almost orthogonal enough that it doesn't matter?
Yeah, so the question is whether you have to pick the weights in some specific way, or if they're just independent. And in this case, I picked them independently. I guess it's like if you want to make this analogy here work, like this is a random orthogonal projection. In practice, I'd say it doesn't make a huge difference. Like the point is that you want to include all data, and what you do precisely doesn't matter. Also, like if you pick the weights between like 0 and 1 or 1 and -1 or whatever, doesn't make a huge difference.
So wait, what do you mean of weights?
So basically, the question is, what are weights in this case? Basically, what you do is a scalar product, like a dot product, between your data, which is like a long vector of numbers. Like one data point is basically characterized as a lot of numbers. And now you take a second vector of the same size, which are your weights. Those are the randomly chosen things. You multiply them pointwise. Basically, you multiply each with the matching one. and then you sum the entire thing up into a single number. And it gives you one number. So basically, one vector of weights plus one data point gives you one number. You do this like 100 times, then you have 100 random vector, 100 random like dimensions. That is like your random projection into a 100-dimensional space. And yes, in this case, basically, as I just described it, the dimensions are fully independent, like what you asked. You could do other things, like there might be reasons to do other things, but the elegance is really that you can just start with a few dimensions and just add some more because they're completely independent.
Is probably obvious, but it has to be stated. In this particular case, of course, the example is chosen very specifically to highlight, okay, in three dimension, in this projection, regardless of from what angle you were to look at it, it would instantly be obvious to a human that yes, it's a smiley face. But that doesn't imply that the data projection that you got out of it, of the real data there, that actually is something. It's not really representing something. It's an artifact of your calculation, but it helps you figure out outliers that are interesting to look for, figure out what's going on.
Yeah, so there's this one important thing to keep in mind, which is this is a randomized method. It can just not work. Like this is a very normal thing. Randomized methods can just not work. You could just randomly choose the weight 0 like a million times.
Or let me really use a different example. If I watch clouds and I see a structure in it, of course we know this is just a pattern that I imply into this cloud. It's a random noise thing. But yeah, it is relevant that maybe some part of the cloud sticks out and I want to know what happens there.
Is it, the question goes a bit in the direction of, is it possible that what we see here is just like artifacts and like not actual effects? And I would actually argue a bit against that. Basically, the point is that because the method is so simple, it is very unlikely to produce anything that is not there from the beginning. Of course, it is randomized, it might not work, but also there, the interesting effect is that the higher dimensional you get, the less likely it is to fail for random reasons. Like, sort of drawing a 0 3 times in a row, there's a chance. Drawing a 0 a million times in a row, very unlikely. So, like, this method happens to be extremely robust in a high dimensional space. If you do this in, like, I may have taken like 2 or 3 attempts to actually get a nice picture here. Like, this is actually cherry picked, yes. But basically, the bigger risk is, can you see things which are not there? And I would argue that's somewhat unlikely. Of course, if you have lots of noise in the input data, you could see noise in the output as well. But that is just always there. Like, it is actually in your data. So if your data has stuff in it that you don't care about, sure, that will fall out as well.
Yes.
I mean, I guess I would stress that the specific application here is to you detect faulty sensors. So you know there is like the, you know, normal data cloud, and because of the faulty sensor or some defect in the system, there will be something that is completely different. And that's what you're trying to find. Mm-hmm. And that is going to be like an inherent big outlier on possibly multiple dimensions, and therefore it's this method would seem to work.
Yeah, so basically the point was that this works here because this is basically specifically for faulty detectors. And yes, this is somewhat correct, but basically what's going on here is we are doing the general domain of like novelty detection, outlier detection, so this is a whole space in machine learning. This is, of course, a aggressively unsupervised method. Like normally unsupervised means you train on the entire data, but you don't have labels of what is good and bad. In this case, you don't even train on the entire data. Like you just look at it once. But yes, like of course it only works because the application is like an application where this works. But it is a pretty broad domain. Outlier detection is generally something you want for a lot of things, especially in monitoring. Like what I pointed out here in the beginning, basically the reason also why in the end this didn't really take off, like nobody really cared too much about this result, is that the main point is actually the certification. Like the main point is that in the end, we want to know if the physics are good. And that depends not just on the data, but also on the precise conditions that the accelerator is running at and that sort of thing. Basically, there's a lot of stuff that goes in there. And there we consider all the data blocks independently. Well, what I did here is more like a monitoring thing, where basically you want to know, is the data you collect right now different from data you saw like a bit earlier. It is not strictly a sort of live monitoring thing, because in the end the threshold is applied to sort of like based on an absolute threshold, not based on a relative threshold. But it is more of a compare different blocks of data to each other than a assess whether this block of data is actually good. So yes, that is a valid constraint, and of course you have to pick a method that works for your use case. Good. Anything else?